Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thanks for tuning in to episode 91 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs where you can download us after our Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Broadcast. And remember, I don't know you're a listener till I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Now let's go to this week's guest. Alan Cassells is a drug policy researcher affiliated with the School of Health Information Sciences at the University of Victoria in Canada. He's worked on a variety of research and evaluation studies for the past 10 years, focusing on the impact of provincial drug benefit policies on consumers, and has specialized in examining how clinical research information and experience on drugs gets communicated to policymakers, prescribers, and consumers. Alan led the first ever evaluation of Canadian newspaper coverage of new drugs, which was published April 2003 in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and has frequently reported on consumer issues related to pharmaceuticals for magazines, newspapers, and the CBC radio program Ideas. He's co-author with Australian journalist Roy Moynihan of the book Selling Sickness, which came out in 2005, about the role of the pharmaceutical industry in helping to create and market illness. Also author of Seeking Sickness, The ABCs of Disease Mongering, and the Cochrane Collaboration, Medicine's Best Kept Secret. And finally, his website is alancassells.com, or Cassells, I'm not sure about that, I'll ask him in a second, with a double S. I'll put a link in the show notes so that everybody gets the spelling right. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you for having me.
So what got you started on critiquing modern medicine instead of just being a cheerleader like so many other people?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I guess what got me started really, just out of university, I started working on a research study, and it was just going to be a very short-term job administering this study that was happening in British Columbia. And it was just so fascinating, I said, this is something that I think I'm going to spend more time on, and that led to another career and another research study, and, 21 years later, I'm still doing the same thing. I've always been fascinated by what I would say is the gap between what the marketers, what the manufacturers say about their products and what the science says about their products. There's always this significant gap, and it's very easy to be misled when you listen to those who are funded by the industry, because they often will give the most rosy picture of their products and really forget or possibly downplay the not so rosy picture of their products.
Right, which could be lack of efficacy or side effects that they don't really want to talk about.
Or harm, and significant harm, too. I mean, there are some colleagues of mine who study drugs say that the contribution of pharmaceuticals to essentially the death rate is quite high. Some would peg it between the third and the fifth leading cause of death is pharmaceuticals. So, these are not minor issues. They can add greatly to people's quality of life and sometimes their quantity of life. But if they're not used properly or misused, they can really shorten people's lives too.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would say, okay, well, we everybody knows that the pharmaceutical companies are in it for money, but we've got the MDs in there, and their role is to evaluate the evidence and to tell us when we go in whether a drug is good or not. So what's wrong with that system that's being set up?
Yeah, there are very, very well-educated, well-meaning, very experienced doctors who do the right thing. but at the same time, it's undoubted. You can't counter the fact that a lot of the education, the continuing medical education of our physicians, comes at the hands of the pharmaceutical industry. And doctors would admit that there's, many doctors anyways, would admit that there's far too much coziness between the drug companies and prescribers, and I would agree with that. In fact, you know, this is something that has been extensively studied, and that physicians who have more contact with the pharmaceutical industry, ironically, are worse prescribers. They're more likely to prescribe drugs when non-drug treatments would be better and cheaper. They're more likely to prescribe brand name drugs when generic drugs are available, and they're much more likely to prescribe newer drugs when older proven treatments exist. And so, you know, we live in this weird situation where we allow the education and the ongoing professional development of our physicians to be handed off partly to the pharmaceutical industry, and I find that state of affairs to be quite appalling.
Right, and there is a huge amount of money that drug companies pump into doctors through freebies like meals or subsidized trip to a conference or consulting arrangements where sometimes the amount of money seems out of line with the services that are provided, but they tend to bring doctors in line with, okay, let's prescribe this heavily promoted new drug.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And you know, it's not just the overt marketing by the pharmaceutical industry that is the problem. One of the major problems is that a lot of the guidelines, say the guidelines around diseases such as osteoporosis, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, depression, the guidelines which physicians pay attention to some degree and which influences what they do, those guidelines have the guideline writing process is highly influenced and affected by pharmaceutical money. For example, if you looked at the guidelines around diabetes, the Canadian mm-hmm. Diabetes Association guidelines, the numbers of conflicts of interest, the numbers of contributors to those guidelines, the conflicts of interest are so extensive it takes up several pages to describe them all in
wow.
the back of the guideline. Yeah, and so you ask yourself, why does it seem like physicians are so eager to test people's blood sugar and then give them a drug? Well, when you see how much money and attention the pharmaceutical industry is spending on treating type 2 diabetes and educating doctors about it and influencing guidelines, you realize what a racket they've got going.
Well, one of the questions I've always had is, like, what's the incentive for doctors to prescribe more drugs? Because, I mean, doctors don't get a kickback if they prescribe drugs. Like, if you go in and the doctor talks to you about getting more exercise and eating better and stuff, that's the same value to the doctor as if he goes in and prescribes you 20 drugs. So
yes.
why would a doctor be inclined to prescribe drugs under that system?
Yeah, well, they might be inclined because they believe that the drugs are going to do some benefit. And so there may not be anything wrong with that. Again, a pharmaceutical is a very quick way to end a consultation. And I think this is one of the problems in medicine, the way that it's paid for in practice, say in Canada, in the fee-for-service system. The doctor gets a set fee for a visit, and
right.
whether that visit takes a half an hour or 10 minutes, they get the same amount of money. And so you can imagine there is a lot of incentive to make the visits kind of short and to the point. And one of the best ways to end a visit is to write a prescription, give a free sample, give a renewal. It kind of signals the end of the consultation.
Somebody likened it to communion at a Catholic
yes,
church.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a ritual, and you know, I'm not overly picking on doctors here. Some people expect it. In fact, some people mm-hmm. will say. They haven't got their money's worth unless they've walked out with a new prescription, right? So there is the undoubted effect of patient demand on, you know, and doctors are kind of in the you know, the patient satisfaction business, right? They want to give people mostly what they want, and if people are expecting a drug, they will give it. And, you know, the other thing, too, is that if you're talking about type 2 diabetes, where really the first line, most important thing is to get moving, to get more exercise, to modify your diet, to, you know, just be more active, it's really hard for doctors to do that in a 10-minute visit.
Once a year, maybe, to tell you you should eat better and get more exercise, probably not going to have a huge impact. I agree. I mean, much better to go to a personal trainer or something like that if you really want to change
those
or
even
issues.
Even nothing that more elaborate. Instead of, you know, watching 2 hours of TV at night, maybe only watch 1 hour and go for a walk.
Yeah.
So it's a lifestyle. You know, the idea of being active, as you know, is very important for all aspects of health. And you know, doctors don't have a lot of time to counsel people on how to do it, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're really set up to fix people who are ill. I mean, what do you think about the annual checkup? Some people have said it's absolutely mandatory. Other people say it's just a way to get you into the system. They check your blood pressure, check your cholesterol, and they're going to find something that puts you on a pharmaceutical if they
I've written about this, and I've studied this, and I can tell you that the annual physical, as they call it, mm-hmm. where people believe that just like getting your car checked in, you know, once a year, whether it's running properly or not, is a great way to be proactive, to find problems before they arise and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's been studied quite extensively, and I can tell you that the research has basically shown it's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but let me qualify that. You know, if you've got any symptoms, any concerns, any lumps, any weird things happening, you should go to your doctor. So
yes, it makes sense that if you do have a medical condition,
right,
that you go seek some help.
Right.
But
if you're otherwise healthy, does that mean you should, like, put it in your calendar to make a doctor's visit once a year? I don't think so. And in fact, you are more likely to be given tests. You'll be more likely to be presented with treatments. You will be more likely to have the doctor find something wrong with you that isn't actually ever going to hurt you if you persist in having these annual visits.
Right. We need to talk about screening tests, because I mean that would be a large part of a physical, I imagine. I personally haven't gone for a long time, but. Cholesterol, blood pressure, there's any number of tests that can be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, in general, what's the problem with screening tests to find illnesses years before it would otherwise be detected?
Yeah, you might not have mentioned it in my bio, but I've written a book about medical screening called Seeking Sickness, and the subtitle to that is Medical Screening and the Misguided Hunt for Disease.
Yeah, I did actually mention Seeking Sickness, but I didn't describe it, what it was about.
So let me give you the short thumbnail of that. In that book, I describe 10 different screening tests, everything from screening for depression to blood pressure to cholesterol and various cancer screenings, lung cancer screening, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and so on. You know, the commonality of all the screening is that if we can find signs of disease early enough to be able to do something that alters the course of that disease, then we absolutely should do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we can find early examples of cancer cells in the cervix by doing a pap smear on young sexually active women, and, you know, recommend that test every couple years, that's a good idea, because that is a test where you can actually do something to prevent the course of the disease. Other types of screening, though, are really not a good idea. And I know some of your listeners are going to be surprised when I say that the prostate screening is a very bad idea. So this is the PSA test,
right,
is a blood test that they recommend men, you know, 50 and over get every once in a while. It can find an antigen in your blood, which can be a precursor or a sign of prostate cancer. Well, most people, if they get this test, I think most men in their 60s or 70s who get this test, a good portion of them are going to have a high reading. So the,
right.
the PSA test will be high. Doesn't mean they have that prostate cancer, but it, what it does do is it can lead to all kinds of downstream effects, including having a biopsy, which can be can have serious consequences as well, and can lead to, you know, men being treated for prostate cancer. You know, the sheer fact is that most men will die with prostate cancer, but not because of it.
Right. There was a Danish study, I think, that found, men who were like 80 years old, the majority of them had a prostate cancer, but they'd all died of something else.
That's right. That's right. In fact, and I know this because in my book I quote a study where they do autopsies on men who die suddenly. So they'll find, you know, a fairly large cohort of men who have died in either industrial accidents or car accidents.
Right.
And then they'll inspect their prostates and they'll find that, these men all had, a good portion of them had prostate cancer.
Right.
But, it's one of those things that you can have it for 50 years and it may never affect your life.
Yes, we've also interviewed Peter Gotchi on the issue of mammography. He's been very critical of that, saying it basically just brings more people in for biopsies and unnecessary surgeries without actually having any impact on the overall death rate.
Absolutely, and mammography is another good example, and I quote Peter Gotchi quite extensively in my book about how the mammography is very much a big industry. There's lots of money in it. And there's lots of people who believe that their lives have been saved by it, but when you look at the evidence, you find the number of lives saved through annual mammograms is actually very, very small.
Close to zero, I think.
Yeah.
it's interesting psychology, because if you go in for a mammogram or a PSA test, and you really don't have a cancer that's going to kill you, but you're treated, and then you return to some degree of good health, and the doctor says, okay, you no longer have cancer, well, you really think that the doctor's done a good thing.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, maybe that cancer wasn't there or would never have caused you harm within your lifespan.
That's right.
Of course, you don't know. Peter Gotchi works with the Cochrane Collaboration, and you said that Canada had ended funding for this. Can you explain what the Cochrane Collaboration is and why you think it's important?
Right. Okay, so the Cochrane Collaboration is a group of, an international group of something like 30,000 researchers and consumer advocates and policymakers and clinicians who look at the evidence around health treatments. And so, if you want to find, does this treatment work better than, say, that treatment, oftentimes there will be a review. There will be somebody who has asked that question, has searched the literature from around the world, and been able to sort of pull all the studies together in one spot. And that's essentially what the Cochrane Collaboration does. They have review groups and they've got more than 5,000 published reviews on all areas of medicine. I think they've been going since 1993, and they've largely depend on public funding. So national governments around the world fund the Cochrane Collaboration, was true in Canada until last fall when they had their funding cut by the Canadian government. They were only getting about $2 million a year, which is really a drop in the bucket when you consider their massive output.
Well, when you consider the cost of prescribing drugs that aren't useful, in a country like Canada with over 30 million people, it's got to be a lot more than $2 million a year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the we spend $30 billion a year on prescription drugs in Canada, prescription and non-prescription drugs in Canada. So $2 million is just like a rounding error.
Right. And this was the previous government that canceled this, or the new?
No, it was the previous government.
One of their last moves.
Yeah, I mean, some people were saying this was an example of, another example of Harper's war on science. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but the new government could certainly reverse that decision quite easily, but they haven't yet.
Yeah, that would be nice to see. One thing I was that happened just recently.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Chris Shaw.
I do.
University of British Columbia. He's an expert on aluminum and things like that. And he published a paper, which I haven't actually been able to read, but it was an animal study related to the HPV vaccine, or maybe related to the use of aluminum.
Yeah.
And the Elsevier Journal vaccine first kind of pulled it temporarily and then rejected it. And Shaw wrote to me and said, the paper has now been rejected, claiming, quote, serious flaws without specifying what these might be.
Yeah.
There's no comment at all. Seems that this is the new shorthand for we don't like it, but we aren't saying why. And indeed, a retracted article seems so much more onerous than a rejected one.
Yes.
I agree that this is the new tactic for the pharma industry.
Yeah.
I think that's what he was saying.
Yeah, I talked to Chris Shaw about that, and so I'm well aware of what you're talking about. So typically, you know, it's very hard to get negative research published, right?
Right.
You have a study that shows a problem of an adjuvant in a vaccine, and even if it's only a mouse study, I think it was, or a rat study, that can affect, it just can affect people's willingness to have vaccinations. And, of course, it's a huge industry, and that industry protects itself. So the fact that Elsevier published the study and later retracted it without any really good reasons is highly suspicious.
Right, because it was published on the basis of peer review, but my understanding is that these retractions, there's been a few, mostly Elsevier, I think, where the publisher leans on the editor to... I don't know if that was the case in this situation, but it seems strange that these things would come from the publisher, who is supposed to be completely separate from editorial.
It's highly unusual.
Yes. Yeah. You criticized one vaccine, at least, the shingles vaccine. I don't know how long ago that was, which I guess that's supposed to be late chickenpox that comes back later in your life, and you said it was really highly ineffective. I think you said that something like 5 people out of 1,000 would be protected from from shingles by the vaccine.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I'm not saying people should not get the shingles vaccine. What I'm saying is that if you get the shingles vaccine, you have to ask some questions about it. And one of the questions I have, being a Canadian, is it covered by the government?
Mm-hmm.
So most people in most provinces, I don't think it's covered in Alberta. It's certainly not covered here in BC. And you might say, well, why wouldn't they cover something that's an incredible vaccine? Well, the problem is it's not an incredible vaccine. It has a very low level of effectiveness. You have to, you have to vaccinate something like, what was the statistics? It helps about 5 people per 1,000
year.
So
I think it reduced from like 10 per 1,000 getting shingles
down to
5 per 1,000.
That's right. So if you vaccinate 1,000 people, but only 5 of them are actually going to be helped, you say, was that a good use of public money? Well, the governments look at this stuff very closely, and they say, no, this is not a good use. We don't like the fact that people get shingles. It can be a horrible disease. But 995 people out of 1,000 are going to spend, $150 and have no effect of the vaccine. So is it really a good use of their or our money? And they say no.
And the thing that I think gets lost in these discussions is generally people don't consider the potential for adverse reactions.
True. I don't think the adverse reactions for the shingles vaccine is that high. I don't really know. It's just that I always look at the effectiveness, right? And so because I think that it's on the basis of whether the vaccine is effective and safe. So if it's relatively safe or pretty safe, then you say, well, how effective is it? And, again, 5 per 1,000 people per year. Doesn't seem to me. I don't buy lottery tickets either, because your chances of winning are vanishingly
small. Yeah, I'm with you on the lottery ticket thing.
Yeah.
Although I guess it's a small amount of money.
Yeah.
it seems to me recently that it's become very, very difficult to criticize vaccines in any way.
Yes.
And as opposed to drugs, like it's newspapers occasionally publish articles that say this drug or that drug is a problem. But ever since the Toronto Star pulled their article on the HPV vaccine, it seems like there's been total silence, as indicated by the retraction of Shaw's article.
Yeah.
Do you know why you think this is the case?
I mean, it's a, you know, vaccines are considered to be absolutely essential public health medicine, right? So, and if you can do something to prevent the onset of diseases, horrible childhood diseases, why wouldn't you do it, right? So they do kind of hold a sacred place. But the other thing is that the difference between vaccines and drugs, say, when you take a drug, it doesn't affect anybody around you. It's you're the one that's swallowing the pill, and you're the one that's dealing with the effects. Whereas a vaccine is about increasing the herd immunity. So the more people that have immunity to disease, the less likely it can you know, solidify itself in a population. So, you know, the theory anyways is that if you vaccinate enough people, you know, if you bring the immunity up to a certain level, then even if you don't have everyone vaccinated, the people that are vaccinated are going to help protect those who aren't. That's the theory anyways.
Right.
That's part of the reason why they hold this kind of sacred place in medicine. Though, you know, I would say not all vaccines are created equal. I think the HPV vaccine is an unmitigated disaster, and I'll say that straight up, because there is no proof that it does what the manufacturers and the cheerleaders allege that it does, which is to prevent cervical cancer. There's no proof that it will lengthen or extend the quality or quantity of people's lives. And yet, there is a growing international chorus of concern around the rare but serious adverse effects related to the vaccine.
Right.
So you're vaccinating young girls before they become sexually active, and a small portion of those girls are going to develop sometimes autoimmune conditions and other things. And there have been deaths related to the vaccine. I think related, maybe not caused, but certainly related to the vaccine. And a lot of that information, it never makes it to the public consciousness, because there is what I would call a form of censorship around the adverse effects of vaccines.
Yeah, I think the Toronto Star basically just documented some stories of girls who had suddenly become disabled after the vaccine, and they said this isn't proof that the vaccine caused it, but that was enough to cause this outcry, and the eventual abject retraction of the article by the newspaper.
Yeah.
It seems to me that HPV in particular has taken on a lot of moral baggage. Like in Calgary, we have a very outspoken Bishop Henry,
okay,
who I'm not a big fan of,
okay,
in many ways, but he was opposed to HPV, and I agreed with him on that, and it sort of became, you're either an irrational person driven by spiritual beliefs, or you're a rational supporter of HPV, which I didn't think was the right argument at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. Are you talking about this sort of, so he was opposed to it on religious grounds?
He was opposed to it on moral grounds, because
he
basically said, look, these girls are not sexually active. Why are you giving them a vaccine that protects them against sexual activity? We should be teaching them not to have sex before they're ready. I didn't really buy that argument, because I know that teenagers are going to have sex no matter what you say.
Well, certainly if you tell them not to do it.
Yeah, that just increases the risk. And abstinence education has been an abject failure.
Oh, yeah, it's silly, right?
But the other side was, well, basically the vaccine is safe and effective. But as you pointed out, like the Nobel Prize citation for HPV says, it will be decades before we know whether this reduces the risk of cancer.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to do, right?
And
we don't know if it does it at all.
Absolutely. And you know, it may prove to have some benefit in the long term. But the fear mongering around it has been intense. And, you know, we already have a proven screening method to detect and, you know, prevent the worst aspects of cervical cancer. So, and this is the Pap smear, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. If you push the HPV vaccine and get people believing that it's going to protect them from cervical cancer, and they don't take the other kind of protections they need, which is practicing safe sex and getting the Pap smear, then you're defeating the purpose. So even on sort of just practical grounds, the promotion of the vaccine to me seems kind of irrational.
And cervical cancer, I mean, when I looked at the statistics, in the United States it was just a few hundred deaths a year, I mean, which is not insignificant, but it's hardly one of the major cancers.
Yeah, exactly. So
another thing that you've talked about in your books is what's sometimes referred to as disease mongering.
Yes.
Like, can you define that and give some examples?
I've actually written a book about disease mongering.
Okay, what was the name of that book?
That was called The ABCs of Disease
Mongering. Oh, okay, yes, I did mention that.
And so, you know, disease mongering is, you know, a phenomenon that is led by largely those in the pharmaceutical industry, but not completely. So a disease mongering is really the exaggeration, the creation and really the exaggeration of disease in order to sell products. And, you know, we see disease mongering in almost every area of medicine where there's a drug involved. I mean, even something as benign as, say, your blood pressure is subject to disease mongering, where you've got the industry and their funded surrogates going on about, oh, we have an epidemic of pre-hypertension. So this is people who are not quite yet hypertensive, but have kind of borderline high blood pressure. Oh, by the way, the blood pressure, what is considered high, continues to drop. You know, right. 15 years ago, if your blood pressure was 160 over 90, the doctor would say, you know, have a good day. Well, today I can tell you, if you go to your doctor and it's 160 over 90, he's going to give you 2 and maybe even 3 blood pressure pills to bring it down.
Mm-hmm.
What has changed over time? Well, the pharmaceutical industry has very much been involved in shaping and scaring people about their blood pressure. They've been disease-mongering around our blood pressure. And not only just patients, but also, you know, they have their hands in the guidelines around hypertension. You know, they say that lower is better. So if your blood pressure is 130 over 80, well, you should bring that down to 120. And, you know, this may not surprise some of your listeners, but in the elderly, you know, say people over 75, if they need a certain level of blood pressure in order to maintain cognitive function, and when you try to drive their blood pressure to ultra low levels, you end up people with low blood pressure, and they faint and they break hips and things like that.
So it's
quite a serious public health problem that you're mongering. You know, you're scaring physicians and patients into thinking they need to have their...
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to get people to take drugs that they don't need, but here you're saying that these are actually pushing them into other health problems.
That's right.
I mean, there have been diseases, like the one that sticks in my mind was shaky leg syndrome, which was a complete invention of a drug company.
Yeah, you mean restless leg syndrome.
Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is... That's a great example of disease mongering. You know, they've developed a drug that treats this so-called condition, and they have to get out there and market the disease. Which you think, why would you have to do that? Well, because if you don't tell people that they have a disease, then they won't go seek, you know, the treatment. And you know, all of the ads, all of the so-called public service messages, they always end with the same tagline, which is, see your doctor.
And in many of these cases, because it's a newly invented disease, there's only one patented solution. So if they say, go see your doctor for restless leg syndrome, there's only one drug, or when they invented it, there was only one drug that you could get.
And the reason why they're saying see your doctor is because the pharmaceutical reps have already seen your doctor, and they have dropped off the free sample. So it makes for a very quick visit. You go in, you say, you know, I can't sleep at night because my wife keeps complaining that I'm kicking her with my restless legs, and the doctor says, here you go.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a disease, and it seems, I don't know if you deal with psychiatric disorders a lot, but the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, seems to be perfect for disease mongering, because you can add like mathematical phobia or something.
Yes.
And then you can give people drugs because they don't like mathematics at school.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there are some really great examples. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but I actually made up my own disease.
Oh, yes. What is it?
Well, it was a disease that I created to launch one of my radio documentaries that I did for CBC. The name of the condition was called AMDD, which stands for Adolescent Motivational Deficiency Disorder. Which
I think about 99%.
Yeah, it's very high and serious.
Yes.
So we used to call them lazy teenagers, but now we can say no, these are adolescents that have they're deficient in motivation.
AMDD, okay, I'll remember that.
And we have a drug for it, and we tested it in a placebo-controlled trial, and we found that, you know, a significant number of teenagers, you know, turned off their video games, got up, you know, got jobs at a higher rate than those on placebo.
Yes, it was funny. I was just watching a movie last night which showed some very rich and bored housewives. It wasn't that TV show, but it was a little bit more sophisticated than that.
Yeah.
But in the beginning of the movie, one of them takes out some Prozac from her purse.
Yeah.
But then halfway through the movie, they have this discussion, and another woman says, you know, I've tried taking drugs, but I find it just makes my mind feel muffled.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, I don't feel life anymore once I take these drugs. So later in the movie, she threw out the package of Prozac, which was, was glad to see that happen.
Wow.
You also commented on fluoridation, which has come up again in Calgary, because there was a paper published that said that Calgary's increase in cavities is higher than in Edmonton, and therefore we shouldn't have stopped fluoridation in the city of Calgary.
Yeah.
What's your take on fluoridation?
You know, I'm not an expert of fluoridation, but I do know the controversy, and I think that my feeling on it is probably based more on just a sort of common sense that I don't think there's anything wrong with having fluoride in your toothpaste, and it's good that, you know, small amounts of it can get on your temporarily get on your teeth where it might actually help the prevent you from getting cavities, but to put it in the water supply to me seems a little too much medicine.
Yeah, because it goes through the whole body that way.
Yeah, and so, you know, and I don't know if it's, well, I suspect it could be harmful, and I don't know why we have such a push for fluoridation in the water, because I don't think there's any good evidence on whether it actually prevents cavities or not. I know there are what you've just mentioned, these observational studies, but I don't know if there's any good randomized trials of fluoridated water. There are, you know, and I know that there is a huge body sort of cohort of very concerned people, including physicians, that think fluoridating water is a really dumb idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And one of the points you made, whatever I read that you'd written, was that there were no really proper clinical trials of fluoride, just as you said, epidemiological, observational studies. And fluoride is a known toxin in higher quantities, so it is cause for concern.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
For sure. So after all of this work that you've done, I mean, do you still have faith in the modern medical system? And do you think it's broken beyond repair, or just needs some fine-tuning?
I don't think anything's broken beyond repair. I mean, there are some fundamental things that we need to fix. We need to fix them soon, because they are, I would say, low-hanging fruit. And and the first one, as I mentioned at the beginning, that we have to get the pharma to stop funding our physicians' education. Like, mm-hmm. Clearly that's not in the public interest. It's very good for pharmaceutical profits, but it's not good for medicine. It's not good for the for the credibility of our doctors. We want our doctors to be prescribing drugs based on good science and good evidence and good experience, not based on what the rep dropped off and how hot the rep was, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being a little facetious here, but you know what I mean.
Well, I do think that the personal appearance of the pharmaceutical representatives plays a role in their hiring.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They actually have been known to hire cheerleaders and ex-Playboy bunnies. But I digress. So, I mean, that would be on my wish list of the critical thing to do first. I think the other thing is that, you know, we've allowed so much pharma money to infect a whole range of aspects of medicine. I mean, for example, we've got funded patient groups, and I wrote about this quite extensively in Selling Sickness. We've got groups that represent diseases like, say, arthritis or diabetes or osteoporosis, and those groups are highly influenced by the manufacturers, even though, you know, when they're challenged by people like me, they say, oh, we take very little money, or we... But it affects everything they say and do, and I think that they tend to contaminate the quality of information that they give to people if the organization is taking pharma money. So I don't trust the any organization that is taking pharmaceutical money. I don't trust what they say about drugs because it's going to be a biased message. And I think everyone should find out, you know, if they're consulting with an organization that, or, you know, going to find out about, say, Alzheimer's, they should know how much money the Alzheimer's Association societies are taking from the pharmaceutical companies, and really temper their enthusiasm for their information, because it's going to be a bit tainted.
There's a lot of pressure in Canada to develop, you know, for some people who consider themselves more progressive, to develop a pharmacare program where the government, for people outside Canada, the government funds hospitalization and doctor's visits and stuff like that, but generally doesn't fund prescribed drugs outside the hospital setting.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we have a problem with what's called polypharmacy, especially the elderly, where they could be taking 10, 15, 20 drugs a day, which can have all kinds of nasty effects. So what are your thoughts on a pharmacare program?
Well, I think national pharmacare is probably a good idea. I mean, we could certainly save money. We could, if we invested those savings in better physician education, we'd end up with better prescribing. So, I think national pharmacare makes sense. But when you talk about polypharmacy, that's very close to my heart. I'm actually working on a research project right now where we're studying, we've actually developed a tool to help physicians de-prescribe. This is to, you know, it's designed for doctors who are looking after elderly patients who, you know, are on 15 or 20 or 25 medications, and they don't want to be on that many drugs. And so, you know, the doctor asks themselves, which one should I stop first? And that's the tool that we've developed to help them make those kinds of decisions. It's called MedStopper. So if you went to the website MedStopper.com, you would be able to use the tool. It's up there, and I would invite your readers to take a look if they're interested.
And does it take into account the side effects that the patient or the symptoms the patient might be experiencing?
Yes, and also, well, it gives advice on what's involved in stopping medication. Some drugs that you can stop quite rapidly, quite quickly. Others you have to taper. Certainly, any medications for any psychiatric or mental health drugs really need to be, you have to be very careful stopping those because of the problems with withdrawal and so on.
Right.
Yeah.
You've probably annoyed the pharmaceutical industry a little bit over your 20 years or so you've been working on this. Have you ever experienced any overt attempts to censor what you're doing or to prevent you from doing it?
Not overt. I tend to be ignored. I would consider myself to be an evidence-based person. I don't trash talk drugs without knowing what the studies have said, and you know, I'd like to stick close to the science. And so I'm very willing and able and ready to debate anyone in the pharmaceutical industry on anything that I've written about drugs, but no one will debate me.
Yes, well, isn't it the old expression that first they ignore you, then they attack you, then can they...
Then you win.
Then you win.
I'm still in the phase of being ignored, to be honest with you.
Well,
but I do have, I should tell you, I have a monthly column in a magazine called Common Ground out here in the West Coast. I don't think you get it in Calgary, but it's a kind of platform for me to write and test some of my ideas. And I can tell you, I've got, you know, thousands of loyal readers who love what I say and agree with me and say, you know, you're actually sometimes too easy in the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. Well, I remember when I went for an eye checkup. It's one of the few kinds of doctors I go to, although I'm wondering why I need to go every year to get my eyes checked.
Yeah.
And they don't really change that much. But one guy said to me, have you had a colonoscopy, which is a strange question for an optometrist. And he said, well, I said, no, I don't plan to have any. And he said, well, it saved me. They found a cancer in me. But I just read this week that the Canadian guidelines are that colonoscopies aren't to be used if there's no kind of symptoms or
that's
signs
right, that's
that might
right.
be a problem.
So I actually just wrote a blog for that for healthnewsreview.org. So I did a fairly extensive look at that recommendation. And yes, I mean, there are a number of ways to do colon cancer screening, and the two that have the best science in terms of good randomized control trial evidence are the FIT test. It's called the fecal immunochemical test. It's basically a poop test where they can discover, they look for signs of blood in the stool. The other test is what they call flexible sigmoidoscopy. And it looks at the lower part of the colon, and it's a tube that you know that they insert and can look around. But it's not as extensive as a colonoscopy. And you know, colonoscopies are fairly major deals. You have to, you know, they require lots of purgative beforehand and sedation, and you know, people can be quite wiped out from a colonoscopy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see. I don't know a lot about the technology, but I do know that the colonoscopy can cause perforation, which is very serious.
Yeah.
If you're being sedated, you could have an adverse reaction to the sedative.
Yeah.
And there may be other issues. Don't you have to... No, I guess you don't need to drink anything. It's not like you have to take barium or something to...
No.
But there are real risks of side effects, which people generally just ignore. If we can find cancer, then... Obviously, that's better than the fact that somebody may end up with a perforated colon or intestine.
Yes. The difference is that in the U.S., they recommend colonoscopies once every 10 years, and the Canadian guidelines don't. See, why the difference? Well, if everyone got who was between 50 and 74 got a colonoscopy every 10 years, then our gastroenterologists that do the procedure would not have time for anything else. I mean, and we actually want them looking after sick people, not screening healthy people.
That seems very much like the whole debate over intelligence monitoring, whereas groups like the NSA and the similar groups in Canada, they want to monitor everybody's phone calls, everybody's text messages, as opposed to focusing on the people who are actually a problem.
Well, exactly.
Medicine should be the same way.
Well, exactly. And in fact, again, if you have no symptoms, then how much will you benefit from having a colonoscopy? What makes most sense is that to tell people to get the FIT test, the fecal test, and if that discovers any problems, then you get a colonoscopy. And that's the way we've set things up here in British Columbia. I think most other provinces do that as well. So, you know, it makes sense to...
And by what percentage would that reduce the number of colonoscopies?
By 90% probably.
Right.
Because most people have a colonoscopy, they aren't going to find anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or they might find something that's, again, like with mammography...
yeah.
or PSA that's not actually ever going to be a problem.
Yeah,
a small lump that gets removed.
And, you know, I did a presentation at a conference once, and the title was "Look Out for the Polyp Police." And the polyps are these small little bits of growth that can grow on the inside of your intestines and your colon and are considered to be precursors of cancer. So when they go in and do a colonoscopy, they remove them.
Mm-hmm.
They put a little lasso around them and they kind of snip them off. You might say, well, that's great, you know, because they're preventing cancer. Well, there is actually no good research evidence that suggests that that's whether you need to do that. Because a lot of times, those are going to be benign.
Right, and if they were cancerous, like you're not necessarily going to be able to remove all the cancerous cells doing that. You remove the lump, but if the root is cancerous, then it's just going to grow back.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure you really would have gained that much.
Yeah.
We're coming towards the end of our time.
Great, because I have to go to the dentist.
Okay. Good luck. Hopefully he doesn't prescribe anything you don't need.
Yeah, or recommend I get an x-ray when I don't really want to.
Right. That's the problem there, too. Is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
No, just, you know, I'd invite people to follow me on Twitter. I'm at AKE Castles. My Twitter handle, and you know, check out my other writings on my website.
Okay, I'll put all that stuff in the show notes. Thank you for joining me today, Alan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. Well, that was a great interview. One of the things I love about doing the show, and I think you may find is different, is that there are actually a lot of mainstream educated and mainstream employed scientists and doctors who are very critical of the system. What you tend to hear on the media is either the cheerleaders for the miracles of modern medicine, as people like to call it, or you have people who are promoting alternative medicine and in some cases have conflicts of interest. Not that people who promote allopathic medicine don't. But here you have somebody who's not employed by industry, who can be very critical of a lot, but not all, aspects of modern medicine. In a Canadian website publication called iPolitics, there was an article on a man I've mentioned before, Dr. Ranjit Chandra, who was just stripped of his Order of Canada. So here was a man who was so highly respected as a researcher. He was given this honorary appointment to the Order of Canada, which is to just recognize people with extraordinary contributions to the country. The article says that he was appointed an officer of the Order of Canada in 1989 for his work on pediatric immunology as a professor at Newfoundland's Memorial University. But last summer, the British Medical Journal formally retracted an article he'd published in 1989 after a growing pile of evidence suggested it was based on falsified research. The study looked at whether babies were more likely to develop eczema if they were breast or bottle fed. And it turned out that Chandra had invented a study participant that did not have any actual data. He very cleverly claimed that babies who were breastfed or bottle-fed a special hypoallergenic formula were less likely to develop the condition. If he had come out and said babies who were formula-fed in any way were less likely to develop eczema, people probably wouldn't have believed it right away. But by including a special formula that he was presumably trying to promote, maybe he had a financial interest, I don't know that, but it's hard to understand otherwise, he was able to get through those screens. He resigned from the university in 2002, 7 years after the university started an investigation. That was 1995. Now, the interesting thing to me is that Chris Shaw recently published a paper potentially indicating problems with vaccines. And that was retracted by the publisher, Elsevier, almost immediately. And yet here we have somebody who objectively, factually faked patients for his research and published papers in 1989 that were not retracted until 2015. So if I do my calculations right, that's more than 25 years between publishing a paper based on fake data and a retraction. Because maybe people wanted to believe it, whereas in the case of a paper that is implies that there may be problems with vaccines, and it was not a direct attack on vaccines, it was animal research, as Khrushchev has pointed out, that gets retracted right away. Retraction is obviously something that's very important in science, because there is a lot of science, a surprising amount of science, that is outright faked. It is copied from other scientists. There are many scientific and ethical problems. Of course, faking is one of the worst, but there are many other problems that can occur with research. But retractions are also used as a punishment for scientists who step outside the main line, and that's something I'm very interested in. I have asked the editor of Retraction Watch to come on the show 2 times, and he has so far not replied to my emails. But if anybody knows of somebody who studies scientific retractions, scientific censorship, or the punishment of scientists who step outside the mainstream dogmas, I am very interested to talk to them. In general, I think I've interviewed some incredibly interesting people. I have a long list of more interesting people, and I really appreciate people sending me tips on somebody that they think has something interesting and innovative to say, particularly people who aren't getting any airtime in the mainstream media. And now an article on breast cancer from Science Magazine, talking about a study published in January in the Annals of Internal Medicine. I was trying to look at the effectiveness of mammography. It's something I've been very critical of. One of the things the study found was that the benefits of mammography, even if those can be accepted as true, are actually declining. In 1975, they estimated that screening reduced the number of breast cancer deaths by 4 for every 10,000 women. But by 2015, it was only 3 per 10,000 women. And you might say, well, 3 or 4 saved deaths for 10,000 women is a good thing. But this excludes consideration of the downside of breast cancer, the women who are psychologically and physically damaged by the trauma that they go through. Another thing that they found was that unscreened women had a risk of death from breast cancer that was 40% lower in 2015 than in 1975. They give a simple explanation for this. This is actually quite complicated because it relies on the number of women who are actually diagnosed with breast cancer. And unscreened women may be less likely to be diagnosed, so part of the reason for this reduction might be that they're less likely to be treated for breast cancer. There'll be more attention on people who have a mammogram in which something is found. So all we can really say from this is that the impact of mammography, if it exists at all, is tiny. And generally, the downside of mammography, the overdiagnosis, the biopsies, the psychological trauma, those are not generally considered in all of this research. Thank you for listening to episode 91 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, question, or particularly a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.